Welcome to the Your Voice podcast, brought to you by ebodyguard.org and the eBodyguard app, available wherever you buy apps. Your Voice is a podcast empowering women to become a victor over victimization. We're changing the conversation about domestic violence and victims of trauma in America. This is Your Voice with hosts Melissa Faith Hart and Melissa Moore.
Hi, it's Melissa Moore, and welcome to another podcast, another episode of Your Voice. We're talking about domestic violence. I'm here with Melissa Faith Hart. She is the creator of eBodyguard Now, a wonderful new app. You can download it for free, but it's all about having a real conversation about domestic violence and having those conversations and also helping you if you're a victim, becoming a victor over it. We've got a lot of guests coming up, a lot of great conversations, and we're thrilled that you're here with us this week.
Thank you so much. And today we have a wonderful guest with us. Her name is Rita Smith. Rita, you have such a legacy and have been fighting the actual fight against domestic violence for years and years. And together with Melissa, we're going to be understanding what that legacy is truly about. What I really wanted to ask you was just to start with today, currently, what do you do for the fight against domestic violence?
Well, actually, I'm a private consultant. After 30 plus years of working in a variety of different ways within shelters and organizations, I am now, I have two contracts going. One is since 2014 as a senior advisor to the National Football League on their domestic violence and sexual assault work, and as an executive vice president of external relations with domesticshelters.org, which is the only online searchable database for finding a program near you in the country.
Wow. And Rita, I may be kind of new to this, and I know Melissa Faith Hart knows the answer to this, but I don't. Tell me how you got involved with the NFL, and more importantly, why? Because I feel like I know the answer to this, but I don't want to just guess.
Yeah, it's not something you would think is like in a place where you'd go normally, right? I think about 15 years into this work. So I started in 1981. About 15 years into this work, I think we all as advocates started to realize that women were never going to fix this problem by ourselves. That we had to absolutely have men step up and start to change the dialogue and start to change the norms. And so I was at the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence at the time as their director, and I just started thinking about who can talk to men, who can influence men. And the answer that just kept coming to my mind is the National Football League. Football players can talk to other men and men will listen. And so I just started poking them. Trying to engage with them. Had my first meeting with someone from the league office in 1998. They came out to a Denver Broncos game, and they met with me and a board member. And my approach to them wasn't about, oh, you bad, awful people, you need to stop. My approach to them was, all we ever see are the bad actors. And I know most of the people in the league are good people. They're good men. They're good family members. They're good community members. Can we have those men speak up about what a good man would be? Because people would listen. And so that was my first approach. It's always been my approach with them. You can carry a really positive or wrong message. So from 1998 until 2012, I kept poking at them and poking at them every way I could. They weren't ready. In 2012, Javon Belcher killed Cassandra Perkins and then came to Arrowhead Stadium and shot himself in front of a couple of coaches. So that murder-suicide was a very personal NFL tragedy. And at that point, I engaged with Don McPherson, who is a former NFL player, Philadelphia Eagle quarterback, really good man doing anti-violence work now. I engaged him to see if he'd co-write a letter to Roger Goodell with me, and he did. And we got a meeting in the NFL offices in early 2013. And from there, from 2013 to 2014, I was working with them internally around their messaging, around information to their NFL family, their employees, all the teams. just helping them get information about local resources. And then I left the National Coalition in 2014, July, and in 2014, August, the Ray Rice video hit.
Oh, wow.
Everything needed to change.
Yeah.
And fortunately, Roger Goodell understood that. And so...
I mean, how could he not at that point? I mean, it's right there in his face.
Yes.
There is a problem, and it's not just something that's outside. It's in the organization, too.
Right. Yeah. And the reality is that I have to thank everybody who ever tweeted or Instagrammed or emailed or spoke up, because that pressure is really what brought the league to the table. That sort of community pressure brought people to the table to say, okay, let's change this. It didn't just take, the leadership in the league understanding they needed to do something, but you all kept the pressure on in a way that made them come in at the level they came in, because they're still involved.
Right.
So you're talking about 6 years later, they're still involved at a pretty significant level. That's unusual for a corporation.
Mm.
So, you know, they did interviews, and because I had been around poking at them forever, I ended up being one of the people that they chose to ask to advise them. So that's kind of how I ended up in a men's sport.
Right.
To make change. But it's, you know, ending violence is about culture change. And we need really good men to carry that message along with the rest of us who are mostly victims. And so I think that's what I want people to understand as we go forward, is that never stop being creative about how we do this work.
That's great. So speaking of ending violence, right now in the New York Times, it just spoke about our lockdown situation, and that actually for domestic violence victims themselves, this is actually a scary time. What are you seeing out there right now during the pandemic?
What I see are, because I know what the potential is, I know that the most dangerous place most women can be is at home. So for most people, when they lock the door, they think they're locking the danger out. Victims of domestic violence, they're locking it in. So when they are forced to be in close contact with the person who is likely to be violent against them, the danger escalates. The longer the time is, the higher the escalation of danger. So for me, this very long, protracted, isolating at home brings real danger. The other thing that I want to point out is that I'm very concerned about the fact that this administration overturned the decision about gun shops being essential businesses. Initially, they were shut down. And the NRA went to the administration, and now they have made them essential businesses. And so gun buying is going up through the roof. That really, really concerns me, that access to guns and ammunition makes the level of danger now not just problematic, but lethal.
I was going to say, Rita, explain just very bluntly, when you say it makes you nervous, explain why.
Well, statistically, in this country, over 50% of the mass murders in this country are domestic violence related. So most people think about mass murders, and they think about school shootings or theaters, but most of the mass murders, which defined by the FBI is four or more people as victims in the homicide, over 50% of them are domestic violence related. So when you add in the factor of having access to weapons or more ammunition in a situation where it's really already volatile, it just really makes me quite nervous about the domestic violence homicide rates in this country over the next 4 or 5 years.
So in these situations where you know that victims are even more potentially going to have this increase, Is there a way for you with domesticshelters.org to be even more prepared to see this victimization increase? In other words, are you getting more prepared in the advocacy groups? What are you doing to prepare to be able to help them? Help them from a perspective of having more advocates at this time.
Right. Well, more advocates not necessarily needed. More information and more access to that information is probably what's helpful right now. So, so programs are open for the most part. They are adjusting their internal cleaning strategies to meet CDC guidelines so that they can stay open and house people. The National Domestic Violence Hotline is operating 24/7. They have multilingual lines. They have texting availability for those who are deaf or hard of hearing. So access to resources is available. Domesticshelters.org, we have definitely increased our information available on COVID response and what people can do if they're trapped. Sometimes you can get online more safely than you can make a phone call. And so we really felt like that upping our game at domesticshelters.org to include information about being trapped with an abuser, and we really don't have an option. So we've done that. And I think that, you know, programs, what you need to know about advocates is that they are committed, passionate, and creative. And you give them a problem and they will solve it because they know lives depend on it. And so I have such great respect. I was an advocate for a long time. I'm in a crisis shelter, and it takes a lot of courage. It takes a lot of commitment, and it's tiring, fatiguing work. You often never see the end result of your work because you're always working in crisis. You don't know what the end game is. People rarely call you back to tell you how well they're doing. So I think that that people need to realize that the resources are there, they're available. Find them however you can, whether it's online or with a phone call. Somebody will be there to answer, for sure.
Okay, so let's talk about the shelters. You just said that you're keeping the shelters sanitized. They're still open right now?
Yeah, they're providing sheltering. Yes, absolutely. Considered an essential service.
Okay.
What hopefully we can do is get some increased funding coming out of the next bill that comes out of Congress to help sort of keep things stable.
Okay.
Increase funding for programs, because of course when people don't work, they can't make donations, and so those things will fall off for them, but the government can kind of step in and increase funding there. So so that's on the list for the policy people working in DC to maybe get more specific funding coming out of the next bill.
Well, Rita, it's interesting. I just talked to the folks at one of Denver's shelter the other day, and they were saying the same thing. You know, we're taking hygiene very seriously. We're doing all of that. But they wanted to get the word out. The shelters are there. They're available. You can make a phone call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And they were talking about the same thing you did, about when you shut that door and you're home and you're locked in a house with an abuser. How in the world, I mean, what is your advice, Rita? I mean, I know it's about survival, it's about being safe, but what is your advice for these women that find themselves trapped and sometimes with a spouse who's just lost a job? And so now there's an extra stress and some extra anger.
Well, my suspicion is that it's very possible both of them have lost their jobs. And so the fact that they don't have income and it's, you know, rent is due or mortgages are due pretty much now. So this is a time period, I think, where that things could get pretty dicey. And the thing I want to give credit to people who are being abused is that they really are, they have honed their intuition and assessment of the danger they're in pretty well. If they're still alive, they've pretty much been able to read the signs. They know how much danger they're in. They know when something's coming. They can't stop it most of the time, but they do get a sense of, you know, he acts this way when he starts to X or Y. And so they, you know, if they start to sense that, I think what they need to do is either, pardon me, they need to either find a place they can safely separate themselves within the house, or if not, they just need to leave. If they could just get out the door, and then think through what they want to do next. But I know most survivors who have been able to read kind of the tea leaves, so to speak, and they can sense when they're getting more and more in danger. So I want them to pay attention to that because it's kept them alive to this point. Respond to that as well as they can. If not, they need to reach out for help any way that's available to them at that moment in time.
So we're talking about a segment and a demographic of our culture that you support right now that are headed towards needing help when they need a shelter. And you really understand that group that really knows the study and the pattern of their abuser. That's who you just described. Talk to us about, before they even meet their abuser, how can they maybe even recognize when they're in the early stages of that relationship and maybe some red flags of the abusive cycle as it's beginning to become abusive? What do those red flags look like that maybe they don't even know that are red flags because they've been taught those their whole life and it's probably a pattern that they're not picking up on? What are those?
Well, I think actually we all tend to downplay some of those things.
Okay.
And so it's not necessarily something that's specific that makes someone a victim. It's that I think we get socialized information that's not helpful about what healthy relationships look like. And so when you're just getting to know somebody, I think it's really important to pay attention to your instincts, because women in particular have really honed self-survival instincts about when they're in danger. Most of the time we downplay them, most of the time we ignore them because you're being hysterical or you're being, silly or you're being paranoid or I can't tell you how many sexual assault victims I've talked to who kind of knew something was going wrong in the environment and they just ignored it for a minute. But they could pinpoint a place and time where I saw a car that didn't belong in the neighborhood or something was happening that felt off to them. Mm-hmm. So I really want people to pay attention. If something feels weird about the environment, just stop a minute and see what, think about that more. So that's one thing, because I think that there will be vibrations, energy that will come off that give you indications that this might not be safe. The other kind of behaviors are, many, many abusers get very involved very quickly. Like things move almost too fast. being in love and wanting to move in and wanting to spend all your time together and, really early in the relationship so that the control starts to become easier because you're around each other more. And, that the ways in which an abuser might start to limit or isolate that person, because when you spend time with Karen all the time, you come home and you just really don't treat me well anymore. Or it's starting to cut off the support system that she may have. Every time we go to your family, they're always talking bad about me. And so, I can't enjoy it. So the ways in which that abuser might start to isolate a person in really subtle ways so that, when you really start to put two and two together, it's almost like you don't have any support systems or access to them anymore. And, if there's ever any kind of violence, like shoving, pushing, grabbing somebody by the face, things that aren't hitting yet, or the overreaction to an event, like he got so mad about something that was, I spent $2 more at the grocery store kind of stuff, that just the over the top kind of response. And then the jealousy about who else the person knows, like, why were you looking at that guy in the car next to us kind of stuff. There's all kinds of symptoms that an abuser can start to exhibit that if you pay attention and think through them, you can start to see the danger signs pretty early.
Rita, tell me, how quickly do some of these characteristics present themselves with an abuser?
Well, you know, one of the things that I have always been amazed at is how really good these guys are at manipulation. They are masters at manipulation. They spend a lot of time getting to understand what that person is looking for, and they be that person in order to hook. So they find out if this is a person who really wants romantic responses. They find out if this person likes animals. They find out if this person likes to dance. They find the things that really this person is invested in and thinks is a perfect relationship. And they be that person for as long as it takes to hook them, to get them in. And once they have them in, then they start doing these other kinds of behaviors that are controlling. But those usually don't come up the first part of the relationship. The first part of the relationship is more about reeling them in, for lack of a better term, getting them hooked to really wanting to be with that person. And then they can let their guard down and be who they really want to be, which is somebody who's totally and completely in control and will use whatever methods necessary to maintain it.
So do you think the abuser even knows that they are doing the manipulation?
Oh yes. Yeah, it is very conscious. It is so conscious. It is a complete commitment to absolutely obfuscating your view of who they really are. They will lie. They will gaslight. If you don't know that term,
yep.
It's good. It's a great 1940s movie that is so clear. They will make you think what happened didn't happen. You saw him turn off the light and he walks in and says, "Why are you sitting in the dark?" They're very, very conscious. They're very good at it, like I said. And so you don't even know what's happening to you until somebody says you shouldn't be treated this way.
What's an example of gaslighting when maybe you're in a conversation and give me like back and forth? If I'm your boyfriend, okay, and you're my girlfriend, and you're the one that's going to gaslight me. So we're, you know, do this for me. Okay, so we're just talking.
Put it in the context of having kids.
Yeah.
And this often happens even after a woman has left a relationship. She has to share custody with their abuser, right? Because the courts are so out of whack, they don't understand the danger that they're continuing to put people in.
Right.
So she has to be engaged with this guy. You can have a conversation about when are you picking up the kids? And he says, "Well, I'm picking them up at 5:30. You better be home." And so she's at home at 5:30, and he comes, and she doesn't come, and he doesn't come, and then he comes at 7, and she says, "Why weren't you here?" And he's like, "I told you I was coming at 7," and she will. You can fight with him about that, but the reality is that they will tell you something that's not true. And there's no way you can win that battle because they will constantly change. They change the game. They change the rules of the game. They never tell you the same thing twice. And they make sure that you are so, it's about keeping you off balance. It's really about keeping you off so that they're the ones who are in control. It can happen about everything. It can happen about, you know, I said I wanted chicken tonight and you cook beef. What the hell's up, up with that? You know, all that stuff. It just, you know, it everything changes at the drop of a hat. And it's always about keeping off balance and keeping you wrong and keeping the one violated.
Well, Rita, I got to tell you, you just said something that I think is going to be huge for women to hear, because we have women listening who have been victims of domestic abuse out of that situation now. But I love what you said, because you basically said just because your relationship with the person is over, meaning a romantic relationship that you had, if you have children together, you still can be abused in that relationship.
Oh, yes. And in fact, the kids become the weapon of choice at that point. because they don't offer them in any other way. And the kids matter a lot to the moms. And so that's one of the ways they hurt them, is they manipulate with the kids, and they either don't come for the kids, or they come too often for the kids, or they tell the kids how she's keeping them from them, or they promise the kids things that the mom would never give them. And there's no conversation about, there's no shared interest in having the kids be thought of as a pair of people working together, but it's constant battle back and forth. And abusers are really good at utilizing the kids in ways that is not just unhealthy, but is sometimes dangerous.
So Rita, then how does a woman deal with that? Because the court says the kids have to go to the fathers, they have to spend time with the father. So really that woman is legally bound into this kind of unhealthy relationship with this former abusing partner, spouse, whatever it may be. What's your advice for how they deal with that?
Well, I think we've put a number of articles up on domesticshelters.org specific to custody, because it is one of the places where it can be very, if not time consuming and financially devastating, because that's one of the things. He can take you back to court until you have no money left. For really silly things like changing visitation days, or I want to change where the kids go to school, or I want to change where, or, you know, what doctor they go to, or just dragging her back into court financially. So we put a number of articles up about that on domesticshelters.org, because we know it's a place where it's just really fraught with problems. And unfortunately, there are some men, some abusers, who will actually kill their children to hurt their former spouse. And so it's important for them to get this right as much as they can, and to find ways to protect themselves and their kids as much as they can. And it's tricky. It is not easy by any means. It is not an easy process, and he's going to do everything he can to make sure she's at it. All the people who are connected to that family need to educate themselves about the tactics that abuser uses, so that they can, in the long run.
I want to speak about that piece, about the victim and the growth process. So as the victim becomes more aware of what she or he has walked through and now is willing to grow out of the cycle of abuse, what have you been able to coach that may happen with the behavior of the abuser in their life, and therefore educated their families about, so that they are prepared?
Well, I think what's important for people to realize is that recovery is a long process. Mm-hmm. And it's not quick. And sometimes you hit bumps where you feel like you've lost ground. And it doesn't mean that you're not okay and you're not strong. And I'm thinking about the current situation right now, where even somebody who's left an abusive relationship, the environment that we're living in right now in terms of forced isolation, mm-hmm. could feel triggering to people. They're out of control. They don't know what's going to happen. There's unpredictability in their life. They don't know where money's coming from. They can't reach out to friends and family personally. They have to do it, you know, in some virtual way. So people who have actually walked away and gotten away from the violence may actually feel triggered by this kind of environment we're living in right now. It doesn't mean that you've lost ground. It doesn't mean that you're not okay. It just means that something came up that reminded you of the violence that you experienced. And my suggestion is just to take a deep breath for a minute, let it flow through your body, and then remember how much courage and strength you had to get to the place you're in now. Because I don't know stronger, more resilient human beings than victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. I've never met people who are more courageous, more creative, more flexible human beings than those who can go through that and get out the other side.
And that's such a great reminder, Rita, too, as these women are, oh my gosh, you're right, being triggered, isolation. I mean, the only person you're with is you, and it's bringing up all your stuff is coming up, you know, and that little hamster wheel in your brain is just constantly going. And probably depending how far away you are from when you got away from that abuse, you know, is probably, you know, where your healing process is and where your brain is at those days. And that's got to be really tough, because especially in this climate we're in, we don't have an end date when we're going to be done with this isolation.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. That's the unpredictable thing I'm talking about. You just don't know where the other side of this is. And so, you know, just keep, like I said, just keep taking a deep breath. Just keep, you know, if you light candles, if you, you know, if you take baths, if you take walks, whatever it is.
Absolutely.
Well, Rita, I want to ask you a little bit. We touched on it earlier in our talk. You were talking about healthy relationships. And we just kind of glossed over it a little bit. For women who are kind of the brain part, that part of the relationship got a little broken and they're trying to put it back together. Give some example. Let's look at the positives. What are some signs of healthy relationships? If all you've ever known is unhealthy, what are healthy?
Well, I think the important thing to think about in terms of healthy relationships is there mostly equal power within the relationship? Like, it's not that you won't ever have a fight. It's not that you're not going to get mad at each other. It's not that that things aren't always going to go your way. But do you sit down and talk through those issues as they come up? It's not about and calling you names and saying you don't ever, and why are you doing this? And if you know, there's a process by which you have some ability to safely talk to each other about what's wrong. And particularly if it's in when you're, you know, getting more intimate with people, whether or not they respect your right to say no, because that's critical in a relationship, that you have a right to say no and that it has nothing to do with them. It's about you. And you have a right not to do things that you don't want to do. And so I think, you know, that there's an awful lot of information available. Loversrespect.org is one of the places where healthy relationships are really well defined. It was created for teen dating violence responses, and so they do have a lot of information up there about what you can look for, because, you know, kids, when they're first starting, they don't know. They don't know what's right and what's wrong, and they don't know that getting 50 texts in a day is probably not, you know, healthy. And yeah, he loves you, but yeah, this is way more than that kind of thing. And so it's just, you know, those kinds of things are really easy to find resources for. But it's really about how you feel in that moment.
I find it curious that learning equality and learning to represent, well, I didn't even know what that meant. So I'm going to ask, what do you think in the process of not just breaking that process of violence, but then learning the process of representing your voice and needs inside of a relationship? What do you think you want to say to the women out there that are listening to this and men, that is a really great way for you as a coach or for you as a consultant, for them to be able to start that journey of knowing how to present their voice in a relationship?
Well, I would probably guess they start with something not quite so powerful. I want ice cream instead of cake. You know, it's like, you know, practice setting limits on things that are not critical to your survival. And do it a lot. Like, you know, I want to go see this movie, not that movie. And like express yourself in a way that's respectful. So start exploring that and sharing that with the person that may have asked you, what do you want? What do you want to do? And, you know, tell them. If it's something really huge, like, do you want to take out this home loan? Yeah, you know, that's harder. And that takes a little more thought process. And so don't start there. Start in the places where it feels like you can practice some safely, and get to know what that feels like in your body, so that when a really critical question comes up, you have some experience with that and you know what it feels like when it's right.
Thank you. I think the next piece of my healing journey has been for me not to just say to my partner, well, whatever you decide. Right. I have done that as well. I have just bowed to their needs, right? And so now I actually take the time and I say, okay, no, that means I'm not in it. That means I'm being passive, right? And then actually that means I don't have my voice involved, right? So now I'm taking the time and I'm saying, okay, this. So when a partner is asking, well, what would you like? And the person that's been through the trauma, how would you suggest that they find that bravery inside when maybe that's so hard?
Well, I think it is hard. It's hard for a reason. It's because when you did that before, you got hurt, like literally may have gotten hurt with the wrong answer. And so the indecision is about wondering if you're still in an environment that could produce that response. So so the reality is probably not, but it makes sense that you would have that come up, that hesitation come up. And so it's why I suggest trying to start doing those kinds of sharings with things that aren't quite so volatile.
So much skin in the game.
Yeah, it's got so much energy around it, because you need to feel like you know you, and you changed in that process of the trauma, because you had to in order to survive. You weren't who you were. You can be more fully who you are now. If you're not feeling the signs of, oh my God, if I do this, I'm really in trouble, just step into it for a minute. Because my guess is that it'll be okay. And even if they get somewhat miffed, you're not going to feel like, you know, you're in danger if they're good people. And you know that. So I think that it's, you know, it's more about you having this former baggage you had to have, this former bubble around you, that you can maybe push out for a minute and let that person in, and do that gradually, so it feels like you're the one in control, because that's what you're trying to regain, is control over what happens to you and how your life is.
And Rita, so many of the women that I've talked to and interviewed have told me this. They said, Melissa, I don't even know what I want, because they have lost themselves in the process. And it's like those small decisions. Do you like green beans or corn? And they're like, I don't know. And it's like, it's part of the healing process to have to check in with themselves and say, what do I want? Hold on. Let me think. Let me feel. Because they never had that luxury before it was all about survival.
Yeah. And somebody else, for depending on how long they've been with them, for a long time. And so you almost forget in order to stay out of trouble. And so now it's one of those places where you can start to really, do I like red or blue? I don't know. Let me put the sweater on and find out. You have that freedom now that you didn't have. So it's a little bit hard to really, you know, be comfortable in it.
Yeah, I think the next portion of that journey for me with the needs and the voice, learning that I now have needs that I didn't even know I had. And now I have wants even, and the difference between the two. Then came the word boundaries for me. And that boundaries for myself mattered, so that I could identify that boundaries for others mattered too. Where do I end? Where do others begin? Was a concept, because my boundaries had been violated so young, that it was okay for me to say, I am not okay with that. That phrase had never come out of my lips until I was 42 years old, until this year. And with that empowerment inside of me, even though I had been a successful career woman, and I wonder how many other career women out there have been successful, but yet from a personal perspective, they don't understand this understanding of boundaries. I wonder about that. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I know that this is not an issue of race or socioeconomic status or even what part of the country you live in. You can be a victim of domestic violence no matter who you are. Your husband could be head of the SEC, because that was true once upon a time during the Reagan years. Or your husband can be, somebody who's a plumber. It just doesn't matter. And so I think that, you know, you can have your, you can be a CEO of a company, and you can also be controlled at home. And so I want people to understand that, that it's not about you so much as it's about somebody identifying you as someone that can be controlled. And they do that. They come in and they find out how they can maintain control over you. So your success is not at question here. It's someone else seeing something of your vulnerability that they can manipulate and they can take control of. And that's what you need to think about. Like, what was it that they used to put me off guard? And what can I do to protect that so that no one else comes in and manipulates me through that manner?
And I'm going to ask one last thing here. It was my success that I hid behind that got me to a place where I was not willing to face my healing. So I wonder how many other people like myself, okay, would not go after their healing journey because shame taught me that it was my fault for the years and years of trauma, right? So I went after success. And only once I was able to see almost like a matrix-like effect that the shame was the lie, that's when all of this started being able to be uncovered.
Well, I'd have to add to that, Melissa, that it is what it probably, I'm not going to put this on you for sure, but it is probably what you thought other people would think of you as well.
Yes.
So other people have lots of ideas about who battered women are. I'm going to use the original term we came up with back in 78 to 80. That's what we called this back when we first started this work, is they were battered women. So people who are abused are seen as weak and incapable, and people have a wrong perspective about, just walk away, think that you've done something to cause this yourself. There's all kinds of myths that, you know, float around in the atmosphere through media and through, you know, other people talking. And so it's not just your personal perspective and your feelings of previous trauma that might have created a sense of shame in you. It's that other people create that and add on to it. And if there's one thing I could change that would make a difference here, it would be that there is not a stigma. Those things have never been your fault. There's one person who's responsible for that, and that's a perpetrator. Someone who is battered, abused, raped, assaulted is not responsible, has never been responsible. Doesn't matter what you wore. It doesn't matter what you drank. It doesn't matter if you were home on time. It doesn't matter if you wash the clothes. A person chose to use violence to hurt you. And that's the person who's responsible for that trauma. Not you. It's never been you.
Rita, I think that is a great note to end on. I appreciate all of your insight. I feel like we could talk to you for hours about this and cover so many things. So I hope you'll come back and be a guest. I've loved having you.
I'd be happy to. Like I told Melissa when I first talked to her, you know, so many women were willing to share their vulnerability with me, women and children who were abused. And I feel like it's an amazing gift that they gave me. I really honor and respect that they trusted me with that information. They taught me, they made me an expert. It's going to do no good if it stays up here. If I can share that with other people so that it helps them understand their life better and that helps them become better, then I'm in. Tell me when I can help.
I love it, Rita. If people want to get a hold of you, how can they get a hold of you?
Well, I'm no longer at the National Coalition anymore. I was there for over 20 years, so I'm not the director there anymore. But if they need to find me, they can email me through contacting domesticshelters.org. I have an email on there. Or rsmithdenver@gmail.com.
Perfect. All right, Rita, we sure appreciate the work you continue to do and just appreciate your time.
All right, appreciate it. Thank you so much for doing this.
So much.
Thank you. I'm Melissa Moore along with Melissa Faith Hart. It is Your Voice. Thank you so much for being a part of this podcast. Please share it. That's really the best way to get this information out there. Share it on social media. Tell your friends about it. It's going to be word of mouth. Let people know, because you just never know somebody who might be needing this encouragement or who might be needing this help. Go and have a blessed day. Thank you, guys.
For more information on domestic violence and trauma issues, visit ebodyguard.org. The eBodyguard app is available at the Apple Store and Google Play. For help 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, the domestic violence hotline can be reached at 1-800-799-SAFE.
Your Voice podcast is presented by the Public Affairs and News Department of Bonneville, Denver. Thank you for listening.